Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon into understandable terms for... Tripped over my own tongue. Okay.
It can get in the way.
Yeah, it can. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon into understandable everyday terms for regular folks. Our goal is to build understanding about the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson, and I'm joined by my co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams-Byers. And today, we're going to take a tour through the Trump cases. We've had a bit of delay because of some illness, but we're back on track here, and a lot has gone on since we last talked, Gail. We've got a truckload to cover.
Oh, boy, do we. Boy, do we. The grass don't grow even when you're not feeling well.
You're right.
It don't grow so, under your feet.
let's start off with the federal cases, and let's start off sort of in reverse order, and that's the easiest one. That's the Mar-a-Lago case, or the confidential documents case. That has gone to appeal. Jack Smith has filed his appeal on that, and that's going to go through a briefing process, and that's going to take forever to get resolved. So that one's really sort of off the radar at this particular moment.
I absolutely agree. And here's what I'll start by saying about that case, Tom, is I think this is one of the things that maybe mainstream media missed when Judge Cannon issued her ruling, effectively dismissing the case, because there was an awful lot of focus on the fact that there was a dismissal and that the dismissal came not long after the Supreme Court ruled on the immunity question. And there wasn't a lot of commentary, at least not that I recall, on the fact that the prosecution still reserved the right to appeal, and that that would be a process that we're now in right now that would take some time for it to wind and meander its way through what we already know are going to be several machinations of hearings and several courthouses. Because what we should have been, I suppose, hearing, and what we hope to do in preparing our listeners for, is kind of not just understanding the here and now, but also anticipating what the next steps are. And I'm really happy to hear that Prosecutor Smith is appealing this case, because first of all, it gives us something else to talk about. But additionally, I like that.
I don't think we're going to run out.
Oh, absolutely not. But in addition to that, I think that there's so much more about this case that yet needs to be resolved in the sphere of the legal contours that we already operate within. And notwithstanding, again, the ruling that came from the Supreme Court on the issue of immunity, I'm really happy to hear that there is, you know, the potential to revive it. Because I promise you, and you know this too, right? No matter how the court rules on this motion to revive this case in Mar-a-Lago, the documents case, the unhappy side is going to appeal it. And so that's why it's going to take forever, because just as sort of Judge Chutkan foresaw, and we'll talk about that soon, is there are going to be appeals. And so this is going to see a lot more permutations before it sees finality.
Let's crystallize the issue in that case, though. It was dismissed after the July 1st U.S. Supreme Court decision on presidential immunity in Trump versus the U.S., and a concurring opinion. Concurring means you agree with the outcome, but for a different reason. A concurring opinion by Justice Clarence Thomas saying that in his opinion, the special counsel or the special prosecutor was inappropriately appointed and should have been not appointed by the attorney general, but should have been appointed by the president and confirmed by the Senate. Now, this is an aberrant ruling, meaning that it goes against all kinds of precedent. I think about 50 cases have decided the other way, but Justice Thomas decided in his concurring opinion that he would make this statement. Had nothing to do with the immunity case, but he'd make the statement anyway.
Tom, I am so glad you said that, because I wanted to take some liberties and say I wholeheartedly disagree with this opinion from the Supreme Court. And you're absolutely right. Justice Thomas's concurrence and his opinion about this had nothing to do with the merits of the case as presented.
Nothing. But shortly, I mean, it was sending a message loud and clear, because just a few days after that, there was a motion pending in the Mar-a-Lago case in front of Judge Cannon, basically arguing the same thing. In a night, I think you noted before, a 97-page opinion that she issued in like 3 days,
which is good at writing and research. I'm not that good.
That's right. That's lightning speed, in legal parlance, in any parlance, even in business. That's lightning speed. 97-page decision, basically cutting and pasting Clarence Thomas's concurring opinion and ruling that Jack Smith was improperly appointed. That is what is appealed. We have all of these other rulings and all of these other motions still pending in that case, but she chose that one to dismiss the whole case. That's what's going to be appealed, or is being appealed, to the 11th Circuit in Atlanta.
And as it should, if I can say this, and our podcast is generally usually focused on the substance of the case itself.
Right.
And in this instance, this is such a, and I'll admit, these comments are going to be a bit of a departure from the substance of the case itself, but it's brought on by Judge Cannon's ruling, because the fact of the matter is that Prosecutor Smith zeroed in on the one thing that perhaps Judge Cannon should have ignored if she wanted truly an ironclad reason to have dismissed the case, right? Given the history of special counsel appointments that this country has seen in so many instances. I mean, we can go from Nixon to Bill Clinton and a whole lot of folks in between. To sort of rest your laurels on this argument in almost 100 pages was almost an invitation to the special prosecutor to say, wait. Not only is the ruling from the Supreme Court kind of created out of whole cloth, Justice Thomas's concurrence had nothing to do with anything, and it was what we would call ultra vires, right? Kind of reaching beyond or outside the scope of what was presented.
Oh, you are so good with that
court.
Latin, boy. You just ultra vires.
And that's what I saw his concurrence as being as it related to this issue, which, again, it also deprived both sides the opportunity to even argue it before the Supreme Court. And so that's why, as a judge, it would have been the last thing I relied upon in making any ruling, because there are so many what I call fatalities to this situation. It's fatal because, again, it really robbed both parties, the appellant and the appellee, the parties that went before the Supreme Court, it robbed them of the chance to even make an argument as to this point, because it wasn't a point when they went there. And now you go back to the federal court, the appellate court in Atlanta, and you have to say to those judges, Judge Cannon got it so wrong because Justice Thomas was sticking his nose where it didn't belong in the first place. He issues a concurrence that's completely out of bounds. And then Justice Cannon sort of sees that not even as a dog whistle. I mean, as like a bullhorn. And she relies on it so wholeheartedly that she dismisses the case. And that makes no sense at all. All of this is really, is crazy, which is why I am so happy that the special prosecutor zeroed in on it. Because here's what we'll also say, Tom, and I think you mentioned this in prior podcasts. How many times are we like counting how many times Judge Cannon has been overruled in the appellate court while the case was pending?
It was so many.
Oh my gosh. It was, I mean, it, and this is not to disparage another jurist, but what it does say is that perhaps Judge Cannon could have benefited by taking a beat. It doesn't matter that Justice Thomas threw that line in that opinion, that concurring opinion out there. She could have just as easily ignored it. And she could have never relied upon it. And she, you know, could have continued to move the case. There are certainly other tools available to the court to use if it finds that the state hasn't or the government hasn't met its burden. But this, I think, was kind of the easy way out that is so lacking in merit and foundationally lacking that the appellate court, I think, will have no choice but to look back at this and say, you know what, this is asking us to essentially turn our backs on what we've done historically consistent with this same situation and now to pretend like none of that ever happened. Because if you do that in this one case, you can't apply ex post facto, right? You can't go backwards and start applying this rule to all of the other cases that you applied it to. And so now what do you say to all of them? What do you say to Bill Clinton, who had a special prosecutor? What do you say to Richard Nixon?
Hold on. Cool down a minute.
I'm so disappointed with her. It's
you're on a roll. I understand that, but hold on because it gets worse. Okay?
Sounds like a game show. But wait, there's more.
But wait, there's more. There is more. And this is a great segue, Judge, to going to the January 6th election interference case, which is in front of Tanya Chutkan, Judge Tanya Chutkan in D.C., in Washington, D.C. And they had a status conference pretrial hearing last week in front of Judge Chutkan, and representatives of Jack Smith's office were there, and Trump's attorneys were there. And one of the issues that Trump's attorneys brought up is that they want yet to file multiple motions to dismiss the new indictment, and we'll get to that in a minute, including saying that the special counsel is illegal based upon the ruling of Judge Cannon in Florida.
And, now, and the directive of Justice Thomas.
Hold on. At the hearing, two things occurred that I thought were noteworthy. Judge Chutkan, who I just think she's a great judge. Judge Chutkan said, I'm not that impressed with the decision of Judge Cannon. She didn't, she was polite in judicial parlance, but, you know, I'm not that impressed. Yeah, I'm not sure that it's going to carry a lot of weight. And
it's
she
certainly
gave
less. It's certainly not as impassioned as my. I'm truly disappointed in Judge Cannon.
and then she said, and to Trump's attorneys, and you're going to have to convince me, if you're going to win that point, that about 50 other cases of precedent are wrong. And that Judge Cannon is right. So that's point one. That's a good segue from Judge Cannon to Judge Chutkan. But indeed, number two, this was reported. According to the New York Times, and I don't know whether you got this, at one point, during that pretrial conference, Trump's attorney said that Justice Thomas had, this is a quote, directed Mr. Trump's legal team to pursue the motion to dismiss. But he then quickly amended himself, saying, oh, but the justice hadn't raised that. He raised it in concurrence. Now, on a serious point, if the justice did, and I hope my journalist friends can get off their ass and follow this up. If Justice Thomas did do that, how inappropriate is that?
Remember who we're talking about. So I don't know that it's kind of beyond the pale of possibility.
His sense of propriety?
Well, how many cruises might have been involved? How many trips abroad might have been involved? And you're absolutely right, Tom. Actually, I heard that quote, but I also heard read that there was an actual exchange, a brief exchange between Mr. Trump's attorneys and Judge Chutkan, insofar as after they indicated that Justice Thomas had directed them to file that brief, her response was, he told you to do that. Are you suggesting that he told you to do that? Which is so incredulous, because if it were you or I, let's be clear, we would have probably responded the same way. I would have said, are you telling me that you're here with this motion because another judge told you to file that? And that's when the
not just another judge, one of the Supreme Court justices.
The Supreme Court justices told you to file that. To wit, I think the response was, well, he didn't say that directly, but if you read his concurrence, it strongly suggested that this is what we do. And so essentially, Judge, we can read the tea leaves and we can certainly decode smoke signals from the Supreme Court. And in our decoding, it has directed us or has guided us to this motion before you right now, which essentially is what that backpedaling was.
He may have spoken truth, though, in his first response. That's why I hope my reporter friends in Washington try to find out if kind of record of that, because that would be the ultimate of impropriety,
And given how we've been uncovering or discussing the inappropriate behavior or the behavior of Justice Thomas in particular that has been a clear affront to everything we know to be within the ethical bounds of lawyers and judges, it would not be something that's terribly surprising to me. Quite frankly, my response would be, yep, that tracks.
Yep. That's plausible.
Yep, that tracks. I don't know that I would be so. I promise you, I wouldn't spit out my coffee if I heard that. I wouldn't, I wouldn't jerk my neck, and I wouldn't jump up out of my seat in shock and dismay. It would be okay. Seems pretty consistent with what we have now learned has been a clear pattern of behavior that has been unchecked. Shame on you, Justice Roberts, but a pattern of behavior that has gone unchecked for quite a period of time, and for whom we've now said there are different set of rules for justices than there are for all other judges, just like we have a general constituency in this country that's saying they believe there's a different set of rules for certain defendants over others.
And that's why Justice Jackson has made some public rumblings lately that she's going to push for an enforceable code of ethics. But that's a different show, different time.
I do applaud it. I think we would both agree that that's...
I agree. Of all the changes, whether they're talking about term limits or stacking the court with additional justices, those probably don't have a snowball's chance in hell of ever coming to fruition. But an enforceable code of ethics is something that is absolutely necessary. Indeed. So back to the January 6th case. Now we're back in Washington. We're with Judge Chudkin. She had the parties file a joint statement sort of procedure, but then had this face-to-face hearing. All of that was scheduled, but lo and behold, Jack Smith comes in with what's called a superseding indictment, which basically means you're indicting the same person, but you're tweaking the indictment. You may change the charges. In this case, the charges were the same, but the underlying basis of those charges can be different. So a superseding indictment had to come from a new grand jury. And Jack Smith had a new grand jury, hear new evidence, and came in with a new indictment to try to clean up some of the issues with this presidential immunity. That was the starting point from this joint status report and the face-to-face status conference, this superseding indictment. You were a prosecutor. Did you do that often?
Absolutely. And here's what I'll say is I actually ended my prosecutorial career as the head of the grand jury. And so when Jack Smith went through this process of seeking a superseding indictment, you can see how non-public it was. I think there are very
few below the radar
who knew anything about it. And there are so many times when we knew grand juries had been seated or grand juries were hearing certain evidence or certain information. He was very, very careful to keep this process under wraps. And I also give his office huge kudos because there were no leaks. And the only leak that came was actually not a leak at all because it was an announcement of the superseding indictment. And sometimes what happens is when there is a superseding indictment, you can have additional charges, you can have changed or amended charges. The idea that it's superseding is that it is largely dealing with the same parties and the same situation, except for the amendment of some important materials within the indictment itself, again, including either the charges or the evidence or the information. In this instance, what Jack Smith came back with the superseding or the replacement indictment, if you will, is the same four charges that the president was originally facing. So there were no additional charges. They are new in the sense that the underlying materials or evidence that was used to support or buttress those charges was certainly changed in light of the decision from the U.S. Supreme Court, which you and I, Tom, we talked about in a prior podcast about this test that the Supreme Court essentially dropped in the lap of Judge Chudkin and gave her no guidance or no anything and said, basically, you know what, you figure it out. We'll decide if we like it or not after you've gone through all the machinations and it's been appealed all the way up here. And then we'll decide exactly, you know, what that test now looks like. But in anticipation of that, and this is the definition of shooting in the dark. In anticipation of that, Jack Smith convened a separate grand jury, which are separate citizens, separate individuals who've never been exposed to this information before, had them consider it, and here they return this new indictment.
With the same charges as the original indictment, but with some significant changes. First of all, we've talked about this presidential immunity. They changed the citation from President Donald Trump to candidate Donald Trump, taking it out of the Oval Office, so to speak, and putting it into a private citizen running for public office.
Absolutely. And a private citizen running for public office who happened to have been a public official before. But those two things are disconnected. And now the reference to him as candidate, as opposed to president, really matters.
And then they also, Jack Smith also eliminated the part of the indictment about Trump's manipulation of the Department of Justice, which was specifically stated as being subject to immunity by the Supreme Court. He said, okay, Judge Chutkan, I'm going to make your life just a tad bit easier. I'm taking that out. We're keeping some the information and the charges the same. We're changing President Trump to candidate Trump. And he submits new evidence to the judge under seal that no one can see other than the judge until a later part in the case. Basically sending a message to the world, I have new evidence with this new grand jury.
Indeed. And that is called an in-camera inspection, meaning when evidence or information is provided to the judge under seal, is not subject to public release. It is for the judge to view and to decide what parts, if any, is actually shared with the defense and or the public. There may be some, it may be all, it may be none, it may be portions redacted, meaning hidden or stricken out so that it is not accessible or available. But here's something to consider, Tom, that I think is pretty amazing, because even with the superseding indictment, with the change of reference from President Trump to candidate Trump, and with the elimination of the Justice Department references, what Jack Smith has essentially said as a prosecutor is, I don't care if you take all of that stuff out, because I believe I have enough compelling evidence to still support the charges beyond right. a reasonable doubt. That's fine. You don't want me to reference the Justice Department. That's fine. I
no
won't.
No big deal.
But it won't change these charges. And that tells me, and it should be a signal to everyone who's looking at this, that there always existed this mountain of evidence, right? It didn't just fall out the sky. Not only did it always exist, the Department of Justice always had it. And that they may or may not have believed that it was important to have included the first time, but they aren't going to be hamstringed by the decision out of the Supreme Court so as to prevent them from still going forward. And that tells me there's a mountain of evidence and we're going to be chomping on this sandwich for a long time.
Well, as we said, Judge Chutkan was put in a very sort of untenable position by the Supreme Court in trying to make this procedure out of nothing. They really gave her very little guidance except on the Department of Justice saying that that was clearly out. We've got issues now coming up, even in the superseding indictment, about the vice president and his role in the relationship between the president and the vice president on the role of certifying the election. Trump's attorney said, we're going to bring those up when motions to dismiss. They said, we're also going to bring up the recently decided Supreme Court case in Frazier, basically saying conspiracy to disrupt official business was overly broad and overly extended by the Department of Justice. But Judge Chutkan said, you know, we're not going to wait around for you to file those motions or to decide those motions. We're going to plug right ahead with my task that the Supreme Court has given me, and that's to decide the immunity issue.
And I really do think that what Judge Chutkan has done is she's worked really hard to kind of quiet the noise, if you will, around this case, because you can have very ambitious attorneys that are focused and interested in, you know, kind of creating the next shiny object, right? If the concern is that, oh my gosh, the judge is not going to, you know, rule consistent with what we hope she will in light of this immunity decision, we need to throw a lot of shiny objects out there for her to focus on so that we maybe never get to that ruling or we never get to that issue. And then we'll, again, be in this constant cycle of appealing, which I think is actually really smart. And I'd invite your comments on this, Tom. I think it's really smart of Judge Chutkan to, first of all, say, hey, look, we're going to focus like lasers on the task at hand, which is dealing with this immunity issue. Go ahead and file your other motions. But here's what I'm not going to do. I'm not going to set a trial date, because here's what I know is that no matter what, you guys are going to appeal. Somebody's going to appeal.
Right.
And somebody, we're going to be at this for a while. So I don't think that that's a stall tactic of the judge. I think it's actually really smart for her not to move forward with setting a date, because remember, she'd set a date before and it ended up being appealed and everything went into a holding pattern. And she's like, okay, so you won't trick me again. I already know that this is the common tactic. And so we're just going to take this one step at a time. And each time it gets appealed and it keeps coming back and it'll get appealed again, it'll keep coming back, we'll move it that way. What do you think?
I think she's been very tactical about that. And she also has made it very clear that the election and the run-up to the election in November has nothing to do with her scheduling, that she is doing this in a bubble that does not include that, which is exactly what she ought to be doing. You know, she's doing it by the numbers, I think, and being absolutely spot on with the way she's handling this. You file your motions, we'll get to them, but we're doing the immunity first. Now, I thought this was interesting. I'd like your feedback on this. Jack Smith's group, you and I, Gail, we talked before about Judge Chutkan maybe having an evidentiary hearing on facts, determining whether or not immunity applied in certain situations. And we said that that would be fairly like a mini trial, almost. The prosecution, Jack Smith's group, came in and their pretrial statements and their status report and said, no. We don't want an evidentiary hearing. Instead, we can give you all the information we have through affidavits and evidence in writing. And we want to give you what's called an opening brief that outlines our case from which you can decide what's immune and what is not. I thought that was a really smart tactical decision, because they can do a lot more in writing with attachments and affidavits than they probably could at an oral hearing.
I absolutely agree. I think it's brilliant. And especially in a setting where you're no doubt going to have aggressive defense attorneys, which is their job, looking and waiting, even in an evidentiary hearing, they're going to be looking to impeach or discredit witnesses and evidence and use that evidentiary hearing as if it were a trial. And prosecutors want to limit as much of that as possible. And also, at the same time, what these prosecutors are saying is, we're not afraid of the evidence. We're not afraid of what will come out. In fact, we'll turn it over early. We'll give it to you now. We don't need to call witnesses in here. We'll provide affidavits, and we'll provide everything that supports those affidavits or those sworn statements. And we will allow the court to make its own determination based on that. as opposed to days and days of hearings and fighting through evidentiary rules, maybe stops and starts or fits and starts, depending upon how that goes. We don't have to do that. And I think that's absolutely brilliant. It doesn't deprive the defense of being able to respond to it. It's that the defense will have an opportunity to respond to that opening brief, but the court is going to make sure this case moves along smoothly. And what else I'd say is in ensuring that the case moves along smoothly, they're also ensuring that each side is given the same type of opportunity to be heard and to respond, and also that the court can rule any way it wants. Judge Chutkan could decide in the end, even after the briefs are submitted, that she'll have, you know, one last hearing to allow the each side to maybe summarize their positions or to make any last comments. Or she could rule on the briefs themselves, which, by the way, is not an uncommon practice, whether it's a civil case or a criminal case. Judges often respond and resolve matters just based on what the attorneys file and present before it instead of hearing from the parties. Sometimes it could be considered, you know, a matter of judicial economy, meaning you can move through things a little quicker and a little more reasonably. And also, it may not be necessary to go through that. And instead of giving Judge Chutkan the ability to kind of decide that on her own, the prosecution sort of, I think they came in first and just said, Judge, if you're okay with it, we don't need any of that stuff, which is why they offered to present never before seen or heard of evidence to her to review only. And I think there's going to be some back and forth over what gets turned over to the defense, just like before. And yeah, she's going to perhaps make a ruling on basically on what's written.
So on Friday, she stated that the opening brief will be filed by the prosecution on or before September 26th. And then Trump's attorneys will have until October 17th to respond. Now, we would be naive to think that all of this is happening within the bubble I said that the Judge Chutkan is trying to keep herself in. This will have political ramifications, and hopefully we can talk to somebody who can outline those for us. That's not our particular expertise, but outlining all of this evidence on September 26th may be sort of the October surprise a few days early.
You took the words right out of my mouth. I was going to say, every election cycle, we talk about there's an October surprise, and this may or may not be it. There may be this and other things, who knows? But given the timing of this, it may be that we start learning some information that we did not know before and that the public would love to be aware of. Yes, I think that in some rare instances, it may shift political leanings one way or another. But quite frankly, the country is so divided. The majority of folks, the majority of the electorate seems to be fairly cemented. There's just a small sliver of undecided that can kind of swing things one way or another. But this, again, this information, it can't hurt to know it, right? If you're going to potentially give someone the keys to the White House, it can't hurt to know as much as you can.
And the media will be all over this for sure. Well, let's move in the last few minutes that we have. Let's move from the federal venues, the federal courts, to state courts, and let's focus in on New York. And let's zoom in on the criminal case against Donald Trump, where we have 34 felony guilty verdicts sort of hanging in the balance, with Judge Merchan deciding whether or not he will grant a motion to set aside those verdicts based on the Supreme Court's immunity ruling. But several things have come up while that's sort of on hold while Judge Mershon's making his decision. First, Trump's group tried one last time to shift this over to federal court. Now, they did one filing that the court went, wrong, you didn't follow the proper procedure, and threw that out. They followed up with
which you think they know by now, right?
Yeah, right.
Because they've asked the federal courts for so much, you would think they were masterful at this.
Yeah, these are high-priced attorneys, but they didn't get it right. The court went, after refile, they refiled. And then Judge Alvin Hellerstein came out with a ruling in federal court going, you know, you tried this once before and it didn't work, and we're not going to take this again. This is a state court issue, and it should remain in state court. Trump's attorneys have then filed another appeal in federal court on that decision. What do you think of that? Is that just a stalling tactic?
That's hilarious, because don't we believe to some degree that much of what they do is a stall tactic?
I think they would be happy if the federal court did take it.
Of course. I think they believe they have experienced their greatest successes in federal court. And after all, even if, and mind you, success is different at each stage. So even if this matters somehow transfer to federal court, and let's say for, you know, argument's sake, it gets transferred to federal court, but the convictions are not overturned. So he still faces whatever penalties the federal court would now impose, which, of course, that's just a wild stretch in my mind. But again, we're assuming arguendo that he faces whatever penalties the federal court imposes. I mean, come on. I think there are few people in the world who would argue that a federal conviction and even a federal prison is probably a little more comfortable than Rikers. If that's what he were facing. So that said, would you not prefer feds over the state court? Absolutely. But to the more important point here, and I actually agree with federal Judge Hellerstein here in saying there are some really clear lines of demarcation between what is considered a state matter and what is considered a federal matter. And just because you are staring down the barrel of what looks like a double barrel shotgun that is loaded with several years of incarceration or whatever, that does not mean that you can now just appeal to the federal court to kind of save you from that. That potential reality. And I absolutely agree. I agree that they said, hey, we said no the first time, and we're saying no again, because the facts haven't changed. There isn't anything about this that now imputes the federal court. And because it doesn't, and no more than we would swoop in for John Q. Public, we shouldn't swoop in and take this state court away from any state if it is a former president. It doesn't matter if there's a state crime that's been alleged to have been committed, and that's what happened here. You had a jury that was seated. And here's the interesting thing is they didn't raise this issue of transferring to federal court while the matter was pending before Judge Mershon. It became more of an urgency after the jury delivered 34 guilty verdicts. Every single charge.
They tried early on, but before the trial, but then had to back off. Now they gave it a second go at it.
Exactly. They abandoned it and still proceeded to trial in the state court. And they didn't continue to say, hey, judge, we're proceeding under protest. We're proceeding because, you know, we absolutely insist that this matter, that this court has no jurisdiction, meaning it has no power or authority to hear this case, and that rather it should be transferred to federal court. They still proceeded. They went through the entire trial. The jury was duly seated. And they delivered a verdict. And after the verdict has been delivered, then they're like, oh, yeah, we need to probably go back to what we were trying to do at the very beginning of this case, which is let's now see if we can still try to get it out of that courtroom and get it into another courtroom because, and I believe this is the case, because they genuinely believe that, A, they have favor, they curry favor with the federal court. And I think that their client is really, really concerned about what the potential outcome could be in a state court, and maybe rightfully so.
Well, let's circle back to Judge Merchan, Juan Merchan, the judge that heard the case, the criminal case, where we have 34 felony guilty verdicts pending. Trump's attorneys moved to move the sentencing, which was originally scheduled for September 18th until sometime after the election. The prosecution did sort of a Pontius Pilate thing and washed his hand of the Alvin Bragg's office, washed their hands of the matter and said, Judge, whatever you want, we don't care. We're not pushing this. Basically dumping it back on Judge Merchan. So on Friday, Judge Merchan issued a four-page ruling saying that he wants to make sure that there are no accusations of the process being unfair or political. And so he moved the sentencing date from September 18th to November 26th. But what's not been reported very often is that he also moved the date where he was to decide the immunity questions from September 16th to November 12th. So all kinds of questions, you know, why did he do this? Is this pro-Trump, anti-Trump, whatever? One reason could be he bought himself two more months to decide this thorny issue of immunity.
If it's not already decided, right? He's clearly given himself more time to write 100 pages than Judge Cannon. And so, in fact, his decision
you mean
is
it might take a couple of months instead of 3 days?
That's all I'm thinking is that, you know, you can't possibly be sleeping, eating, or doing anything else but writing if you can whip out 100 pages in 3 days. That's superhero-ish right there. But in addition to that, so here's my takeaway. I have a couple takeaways, quite frankly, as you can probably imagine from our conversations. So my first takeaway is, listen, clearly we have a judge in New York that cares more about the code of ethics and the appearance of impropriety than even some of our highest judges in the land. So that is clearly
Bingo.
His rationale. And so he clearly cares more about even the appearance of that. And also ensuring and kind of comforting the public in knowing that notwithstanding everything he has endured, and he has endured a lot. He's endured public scorn. His family has endured it. He's been berated. He's been disrespected this entire time.
And,
you know, I think we need to send this man a case of rescue inhalers because I know the air is thin on the high road and he has been living on the high road the entire time he got this grenade of a case placed in his court. But notwithstanding all of that, he is so committed to ensuring the integrity of these processes and the faith that we have in the justice system, yes, even in light of this environment, that he's now literally joining the circus and becoming a contortionist, trying to ensure that, you know, the current experience of us going through a federal election is not a cloud that follows this case. And I do commend him for that. I do believe at the same time that there are some drawbacks as much as there are some benefits. The primary drawback is that when we as judges are telling the public and we tell everyone else, and even similar to what Judge Chutkan is doing and what she said, and showing that, you know, we will not treat one defendant different or better than others, that even in exercising this effort to completely remove this case from the sphere of a federal election, that what it effectively did is it did provide an unearned benefit to a certain defendant that would not have been extended to every other defendant similarly situated. And that is unfortunate, especially when you're trying to walk that tightrope like he is. I think what's more is that by moving the sentencing date, because remember, Judge Chutkan is setting things one at a time, understanding and knowing that there are going to be appeals. Judge Marchand hasn't. And that to me struck me as odd, because he set a hearing date on the issue of the immunity, but at the same time, he also set a sentencing date. Now, is that sort of reading tea leaves as to, you know, how he's leaning and what he's like, how he's likely to rule? I tend to think so, but we've all been surprised, and, you know, dates can be moved. Courts take dates off the calendar all the time. They change things around very frequently, as we just saw. But here's what I think. My last prediction is that by moving this, this is my last prediction on this point, that by moving this to the end of November, where it is, the sentencing date to the end of November, I think it almost exponentially increases the likelihood of incarceration, especially if Mr. Trump is not reelected.
You know, if I were running politics, which thank God I'm not, at this point, if I were running Democratic politics, you could almost use this as a rallying cry. If Trump wins, he doesn't get sentenced. If Trump loses, he possibly go to jail. You know, so that could be a rallying cry to get people out to vote if they're so inclined. Let me read you one thing, and then I want to move on. But I want to get your quick reaction to this. This is what Judge Marchand wrote. This is his quote. "The public's confidence in the integrity of our judicial system demands a sentencing hearing that is entirely focused on the verdict of the jury and weighing of aggravating and mitigating factors, free from distraction or distortion. The members of this jury serve diligently on this case, and their verdict must be respected and addressed in a manner that is not diluted by the enormity of the upcoming presidential election. Likewise, if one is necessary, the defendant has the right to a sentencing hearing that respects and protects his constitutional rights." Now, I think that's a brilliant paragraph that I just wrote. That's number one. But number two, is he sending a signal there?
Again, I think that, you know, if you kind of read the tea leaves, that you clearly see that this judge respects the work of the jurors. He respects and is doggedly focused on protecting the integrity of the justice process. And that as such, I believe he's probably made a decision on as to whether or not those convictions will remain intact and undisturbed, and that his duty in so doing now turns to how to respond to that and how to deliver the proper finality to this case through sentencing. So I think that he's pretty much made it clear, in my view, how he views this and how he views the defense motion to dismiss, even in light of the immunity decision. But again, we've been surprised before. But if I had to make another prediction, I had to make another prediction. My prediction is that will have no bearing on this case, and that Judge Mershon will proceed with sentencing Mr. Trump on the 34 felonies that he was convicted of.
All right. To wrap this up, we're going to follow up with the last two cases in New York. And let's try to do this quickly. First of all, Trump has appealed the $83 million defamation case where he was, or E. Jean Carroll was awarded $83 million for Trump libeling her. That was appealed. But last week, we had oral arguments. Excuse me. We had oral arguments on a $5 million verdict in the E. Jean Carroll case, which was the underlying case that caused the defamation case. That gets a little confusing, but this was for the sexual assault or rape, as it's sometimes been defined.
Can we just call this the can't leave well enough alone case? Because there would not have been a second one if he'd have kept his mouth closed.
So the oral arguments happened in court. E. Jean Carroll was present. This is in front of a three-judge panel of intermediate court of appeals in New York. E. Jean Carroll was present. Donald Trump was present. Heard oral arguments. Trump's attorneys appealing the decision, basically challenging the testimony of two witnesses who claimed similar activity to the activity E. Jean Carroll asserted. And it was interesting because after this, Trump had a almost hour long, I think it was 47 minutes or 59 minutes, I can't remember exactly which, but it was nearly an hour long press conference, a misnomer because he took no questions. He just rambled for the hour, trashing the case, trashing the court, then trashing his own attorneys, calling the oral argument a trial on numerous occasions, showing that he had no idea what was going on, and bringing all of this to the fore again, topping it off, and this is leading to my question to you, Judge Gale, topping it off saying, you know, even if I were to do this, the two witnesses would not have been my first choice, basically saying that they weren't worthy of groping by Mr. Trump. What do you think of all of that as response to an appellate argument?
You know, it's hard to put into words.
You're speechless, aren't you?
How absolutely mind-boggling this is. But again, so I should say, similar to what I said earlier with regard to Justice Thomas, it tracks. This behavior tracks. It is consistent with what he has done before.
I've heard the phrase, shocked but not surprised. Is that
exactly? That's what it means. It tracks. Shocked but not surprised. Here's the other thing. Doesn't it tell you something about someone who has all of these? I used to say, you know, when I was on the bench, and maybe you saw the same thing, I would see some of the most aggressive attorneys on pocketbook cases than I would even on criminal matters. I mean, you could have a very serious criminal case where somebody's looking at losing, you know, scores of years of their life behind bars, and the attorneys are more civilized than them ones dealing with those pocketbook cases. And it tells you something about someone who is a defendant in both criminal and civil matters. They don't show up for the criminal cases, didn't show up in Judge Chutkan's courtroom, didn't show up in Judge Mershon's, but shows up when you're looking at, you know, what, $88 million.
$88 million total.
Yeah, 88 million. And mind you, and with this press conference, you absolutely are inviting yet another lawsuit to hold a press conference and berate the victim yet again, which is what caused you to have a second judgment. Now you could, in fact, be looking at a third judgment. But for somebody who believes they have a money printing press in their back pocket, you know, they are clearly more concerned about the money than they are even their own freedom. And that says something about somebody. It doesn't surprise me that he was berating the judge and didn't know the difference between an appellate argument and an actual trial. This is somebody who hasn't committed themselves to learning a process that they themselves have been entrenched in for years now. I mean, has for the greater part of their professional life, they've had some kind of litigation going on. He's probably one of the most litigious people we have ever heard of. And yet you still don't know the basics, even when it affects you. It tells me a lot. It also tells me what we can expect from you as a leader, because we've seen it before. And now I think he's even less invested in the finer details of how things work. And it's incredible. It shows a lack of respect for anything and anyone that dare call itself authority over him. This is someone who feels and clearly demonstrates that there is no such thing as an authority over him, and he conducts himself accordingly.
You know, I don't feel sorry for the attorney standing there and getting absolutely.
Oh, please!
Trashed.
You know they're gonna build them hours no matter what. Listen, Mister, and I would be standing there. Listen, Mister, I'm probably getting fired after this, but you're gonna get billed this $750 or this $1,500 an hour, whatever it is. My rate is it just doubled because verbal beating in public ain't part of the contract.
Double time.
Yeah, now I'm getting double time, and so you know you may have a history of not paying your bills, you're going to pay this bill and then I'm going to leave. We can part company and you can keep berating me, but I'm going to get berated all the way to the bank. If I was that lawyer, they better go get berated all the way to the bank, because that's the kind of client. And they knew what kind of client they had when they took them on. How about that? So how surprising is that? You know who you're getting. You know you can't control them. There's not a single attorney anywhere that can say, yep, I got client control over this one.
Again, not a one. Shocked but not surprised.
Amen.
You and I have made the rounds here of, I think, all of the Trump litigation, and we're going to call it a day with that. Gail, thanks so much for the conversation. You and
it's
I always have
a fun conversation.
I hope people learn stuff, because there is a lot of law that we talked about today, and hopefully we did it in a way that they can understand and is somewhat entertaining. How do people find us?
Oh, you can find us on all of your favorite podcast platforms. You can find us on Spotify. You can find us on Apple, on Amazon. You can find us anywhere you find your favorite podcasts. Just look for Next Witness, Please. We would be delighted to continue to engage you and to welcome you into the fold, because our saying is people don't trust what they don't understand. And we are so hopeful that in the midst of our exchange that we've helped you to better understand the law.
They also can find us on Audible, and if I got to get a plug in here for National Public Radio, on the NPR podcast directory. So again, you can find us about anywhere. If you have a question or comment about our podcast, you can email it to me at hodson@ohio.edu. That's Hodson, HODSON. @ohio.edu. Also, if you have topics you would like Judge Gail and I to cover in the future, please shoot us an email and we'll try to accommodate you. Next Witness, Please is produced through WOUB Public Media. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and our reliable audio engineer. Judge Gail and I will be back real soon to give you more updates and more insights into the law. Until then, have a good day, everyone.
Have a good day.